You know you've got a comeback in you. When you take the next step, you're going to make it count. For your career, for your family, for your life. You can earn a degree you're proud of with Purdue Global. Purdue Global is backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected and innovative public universities. This is your chance. This is your opportunity. This is your comeback. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
The virus that causes shingles is sleeping in 99% of people over 50. While not everyone at risk will develop shingles, it strikes as a painful rash that can last for weeks. Wake up, because shingles could wake up in you. Ask your doctor or pharmacist about shingles prevention.
Ladies and gentlemen,
we are coming back to Atlanta.
Right now.
Whoa. Mark your calendars, because the second annual Black Effect Podcast Festival is happening on Saturday, April 27th. Hosted by B-Dot and Pretty V. Last year was nuts, but we about to do it bigger and better. We've got some of your favorite podcasts like Carefully Reckless, Horrible Decision, $1 million Worth of Game, just to name a few. Tickets go on sale today, right now. Go to blackeffect.com/podcastfestival. Get them. We'll see you there.
Hi, Brian.
Hi, Katie.
You know, the past couple of weeks, we've been all about politics, but we thought it would be nice to take a little break from it all, which is kind of fitting because that's what today's guest might be best known for, Brian, at least until recently, taking a very long break.
That's true. Our guest today is Steve Perry. He was the front man for the band Journey in the 1980s. And unless you're truly living under a rock, you've heard Steve's lead vocals on the most downloaded song of the 20th century.
Don't stop.
Just hearing a few seconds of that transports me to another time and place, specifically Atlanta, Georgia, when I was working as an associate producer for CNN, and this song came on the radio, and I loved it.
Yeah, and I would have loved it had I been born at the time, but, you know, I wasn't.
Thanks, Brian. That is really
cold. You're
welcome.
You're very welcome. Anyway, Steve Perry always wanted to be a musician, but by his late 20s, he felt he'd run out his music career playing for small-time bands in dusty bars. He left his musical dreams to mend turkey coops on a farm in California, but then one day he got a call from a band manager named Herbie Herbert that would change his life.
That's an understatement, because Herbie asked Steve if he'd be the lead singer in a band called Journey alongside guitarist Neil Sean. Now, with Steve at the mic, the band went on to record 8 multi-platinum albums, toured the world, but the life of a megastar grew kind of old for Steve. It was really hard on him. So following his mom's death, he walked away. The last time he performed live with Journey was in 1987, more than 30 years ago.
And Steve has pretty much stayed out of the spotlight since then until last month.
That's right. After decades of keeping a very low profile, Steve came out of retirement and recorded a new album called Traces. He was motivated by a late-in-life love who made him think twice about how he was going to spend the next 30 years.
So we'll get to his music, his career, and why he felt the need to walk away. Or I should say, Katie, you will get to all of that since I wasn't able to join you for your conversation with Steve.
We missed you, Brian. I think you really would have liked him.
I bet I would have.
And honestly, I could have used some backup vocals. You'll hear that a little bit later on. But we talked about so many things, so let's get right to my interview with Steve Perry. Are you having fun, Steve? Before we talk about your life and what's been going on and how you got to this moment in time, is it nice to be back?
I'm having fun. It's a lot of work, and I haven't been working for a long time, so I had a nice vacation. I think that's probably...
You had a 20-year vacation,
actually,
Steve.
Actually, I left the band 31 years ago.
Wow.
Believe that. Yeah.
I can't.
It was 87.
Wow. And
yeah,
here
February,
we are.
February of 87, I was home, and that was it.
You just walked away from everything. And before we talk about all that, I'm curious what your life has been like since you left the band. You went from such an intense, extreme, grueling, high-profile schedule, right? And mm-hmm. so many demands on you to being able to kind of get up in the morning and say, what am I going to do today?
Yeah.
Was that a huge adjustment? Did you love it? Tell me everything.
It was. It was very, very difficult just to go back to the simplicities of life when, as a child, I reached for so much more. I don't know why I needed more. I think it was something that started when I watched my father sing when I was about 4 or 5 years old. And I saw him sing at the Hanford Civic Auditorium, and my mother was performing in her big can-can dress in the same production. I can't remember what it was, but I remember looking at my father, and he's singing. And I knew I had that inside of me. I just knew I had it inside of me because I said to myself, I can do that. And so I would sing around the house, and then, of course, I discovered music. That was a big part of my life, the 45, so I started playing at an early age. I guess it drove me, the discovery of music and the songwriting, the recording, the sound of their voices, the string parts, it lifted me in such a way emotionally that I wanted to get closer to it. I was drawn to it. Now, you got to know, of course, my dad was a musical guy.
Did he play instruments?
You know, the only instrument I remember is he had a 49 Ford, and he had this big steering wheel, and he literally had a ring on each finger, and he would sit there and go, tick. You know, when some swing song was on the radio, he'd be tapping away like a drum pocket thing, and I would just pay attention to certain things like that, simple things, at a very early age. Like, I'm 3-4 years old, like I said, you know, and everything seemed musical to me at that point.
You just had that gene, I guess. I think I had that hyper-connected, maybe it's an auditory thing.
It's auditory. You're correct. It is auditory. More than it is, I'm not trained. I don't know how to really play instruments. I was a drummer for years. That's my main instrument, drummer, singer.
Do you play the piano a little bit?
A little, enough to write, but I don't play.
You were the voice of Journey. So, I mean, it sounds like a very difficult life. Your tour schedule was so relentless. The demands on you as the voice were so relentless.
Nobody was calling me that then, though, really. But I was a singer, and the demands were the same. You're right.
Right. Yeah. But I mean, I know you just performed, you went home, and then you never went back. Let's talk about sort of what led you to make that decision. And what was it that brought you to that breaking point? I would love to mine that a little bit.
I guess, well, we weren't getting along very well. I mean, the band is a band. And that happens to groups.
Right, of course.
You know, they come...
Well, it's like you spend so much time together, right?
And you have so many different opinions about the direction you want things to go. You disagree and you agree on so many levels. And as it's moving forward and growing and becoming this other big thing called success... Everybody digs in for their own, I think, opinions, and it becomes a bit collidive. You collide, and I think
that's a new word.
I'm making up words. Collidive.
It's like collidive.
Yeah.
I like it.
Yeah. I proceed. Do that. And so we're writing songs here today, by the way. And that's what happens. And we weren't talking much. We were just colliding with each other a lot. And that was going on for a while.
And that's stressful.
And it was. And the touring schedule was intense. And I would have liked to have slowed that all down a bit and been a little bit more, you know, if you go to a hardware store to get a carton of milk, you're probably in the wrong place. It's not there.
So you just felt like your visions weren't aligned?
Yeah. I think I was asking it to be something is what I'm trying to say.
What did you want it to be?
I wanted it to be more spaced out. I thought we would tour for a while, stop for a while, have some life in there. Tour for a while, stop for a while.
And when you would suggest that, what would you be
management
told?
And most of the members, their lifestyles required more, dare I say, cash flow. And you know, my upbringing was Portuguese. My grandfather taught me when I was very young. He said, it's not how much you make, it's how much you save. And I went, what does that mean? He says, if you make $40, I want you to put 20 in the bank, and I want you to forget about it, and I want you to try to make that other 20 work. Forget about the other 20.
I think you must have known my dad.
I mean, really. I mean, it's such wise stuff to hear as kids, you know. I was raised that way, so I was saving my money along the whole time.
So your lifestyle was clearly very different than a lot of your band members.
Very different.
Did you succumb to all the sort of tropes that we associate with rock and rollers and people, you know, on the road?
Like, for instance, give me...
Sex, drugs, alcohol, lavish spending, et cetera,
I have had occasional for the first three, but lavish spending was not my game.
Right.
You know? I thought that was just crazy. In fact, I kept my yellow Volkswagen that was so beat up. I just thought it was fine, you know? That was the way I was raised. When I came off tour, I went home to my mom's house, and I remember coming down, going back in the back bedroom and crashing for a couple of days, and the phone rang. And I swear this is the truth. I ran down the hallway completely naked as a jaybird, grabbing the phone thinking I'm late for the bus because I was in deep sort of like sleep. So that was how road burn. We used to call it road burn, to where you're so burnt because this is what you do. You get in a cycle.
You know, it seems to me from a business perspective, if the band heard your cries of help, that they would not, as my dad would say, want to kill the goose that laid the golden egg, right?
No, I think at the time it was interpreted as just whining, you know? You know? And maybe I was whining a bit because it was hard work.
Well, let's talk about the hard work it was. Because when I mentioned that your voice is your instrument, mm-hmm. it required really an obsessive, it sounds to me, amount of attention paid to it to keep it
neurotic
strong.
Is the word.
All right, neurotic.
It's a neurotic obsessive feeling that you just don't know what you have from one night to the next.
And it sounds like it almost took over your life, Steve.
It does. It does take over your life. Because
so explain that to people who don't sing for a living.
Well, because if the instrument you have is you, it's not just the vocal cords in your throat, it's you. And the vocal cords and their inflammation issues. And if one vocal cord is slightly inflamed more than the other, they don't line up. You've got trouble. If you don't get enough sleep, if you don't drink enough water, if you stay up too late, if you're just completely burnt out and fatigued, that's enough on its own. And if you ask anyone from Streisand to anyone about this, they will say, gosh, finally somebody's talking about it. You know, because the truth is, it is a neurosis unto itself.
Do you think it is for all singers or more for you?
Well, okay, I guess I should speak for myself.
I'm just curious. You've probably talked to a lot of singers. Did you find commonality among you?
I have found this commonality. Most of them will nod their heads and say, nobody gets it, do they? No, nobody does. I understand.
That's so interesting. I wonder why don't people talk about how much care and attention and neuroses often accompany this kind of talent.
I think the word fear, the fear is this, Katie. People have been waiting for a long time for you to sing the songs that they have decided to embrace and bring into their lives and make part of something that enriches their emotional part of their lives. And you're coming to town. And you pull in the day of the gig and you go to the sound check and you open your throat, you feel crumby and grumpy, as I call it, or crusty. It can be really scary to think that you're going to fall short of what these people have been waiting so much for you to give them. It's not fair to them. And at some point, then it is not fair to you to put yourself in that position all the time.
That's a lot of pressure.
Now, I want to make clear, I'm not complaining. I'm not whining. Please, anybody listening out there, I'd like to talk about things that people don't talk about. And this is certainly one of them.
Have you ever been performing and felt that you disappointed the crowd? And I'm curious, what was their reaction and how did you feel?
I did. Now, that's a whole nother landscape of neurosis because sometimes when—
Did you ever get booed, by the way?
No.
No?
Only once. I think I was in Toledo and I said Cleveland.
Oh.
Because I was so tired. So from that point on, between the two bass drums, with a little LED light, the city would have to be written on a piece of paper. Because I didn't want to make that mistake again. That's how tired I was. That's when I got, the only time I got booed. The only other time I can recall was I was so fatigued that all I could remember was the first verse of Oh Sherry. I couldn't remember the second verse. So I did the first verse twice. And I looked at the audience and put my palms in the air like, I don't know what to tell you.
So you were pretty much just completely burnt out, Steve, and you said, I can't do this anymore.
Yeah.
So for all those years, I know obviously you had a solo career after that, but for much of that time, you were just living in California, doing your thing. So what would you do all day?
Well, first, I went to my hometown, and I hung out with friends, and I went to the old ice cream parlor and went out to the cemetery, and I would spend solitude moments with my departed parents and grandparents. And then I had a step-grandmother, and I had my father's sister, my Aunt Betty, and I really, I went back and took care of them, to be honest with you.
But that probably wasn't your entire day. I mean, did you still make music?
No.
Did you still think about songs? Did you, I mean, I know you spent some time at the carnival when it came to town, at the fair?
Well, the fair would come to town in June in my hometown, and I always dreamt of running away with the circus, so to speak, because it would show up and it would be so amazing, and it looked like the island on Pinocchio, you know, the Ferris wheels and the lights and everything. And I thought it was so amazing. And the next thing I know, they're gone. So I thought, gosh, someday I'd like to, you know, run away with the circus. And being in a rock and roll band is a circus life. You know, you do run away with the circus, so to speak. And you do travel just like that.
When you were off and it turned, like, the clock struck 8 p.m. wherever you were, did you ever think, wow, you know, in my old life, I'd be stepping onto a stage right now. I mean, did you miss the rush, the adrenaline?
Of course.
Of kind of just being in that moment. To me, that would be, I wish I could sing. And the idea of just being able to sing something, a song you love, and have people really, you know, respond to it, that just must, there must be nothing like it.
Yeah. To be able to write music that you believe in and have someone else love it as you initially sort of feel like it's worth being loved, nothing like it, nothing like it. And then to record it and they embrace it and then to go out and perform it, it's just the whipped cream on the cheesecake, you know? It really is. It's just something I can't explain. And yes, to answer your question, I really did miss it terribly. But it came with too much, I think, return to our baggage together. I think that, you know, look, they were tired of me and I was kind of tired of them, you know, and I think we needed just to go our ways. That's all.
Well, you did then go on to your solo career, right, Steve? Mm-hmm. And was that more satisfying for you? You did
I really didn't go into the solo career at that point. I did the solo career because Neil Sean had done two solo albums while I was in the band. I told the manager, why is Neil doing a solo album? Well, I can't stop him. He said he wants to record it. You know, so he did a song and a whole record with Jan Hammer. Then we do another Journey album, another tour. And then I told the manager, look, I'm going to do one. He shouldn't keep doing this because, you know, I think it could damage the band at some level. Next thing I know, he's doing a second one with Jan Hammer. So I turned to the manager and I said, okay, I told you, I'm going to do one. So that's when I went to L.A. and did Street Talk and wrote Oh Sherry and Foolish Heart with Randy Goodrum and Strung Out with Craig Kramph and a bunch of friends. And Nico Bolas was the engineer. We recorded that record so fast at this little studio in the Valley. And we had a great time. And the record came out and it was just a great moment. Then I asked my mother, what should I do? Because she was already sick at that point. She was very sick. And I asked her what I should do. Should I go back to Journey or should I continue my solo career? Just to think about it. Please, Mom. Because she was so instrumental in my early years of being in bands in high school and everything. I just wanted her opinion. And honestly, she couldn't talk very well because her speech was severely impaired.
And what did she tell you?
The next day she said, Journey. And I went, are you sure, Mom? Because that means I won't be able to hang out with you. If I do the solo stuff, I can do it at my own pace. She said, Journey. Just like that. So I went back and did the record. If you look at that record, it says, this one's for you, Mom.
After you left Journey, why wouldn't you just do a solo career?
Because that's not why I left the band. I left the band for all kinds of reasons, okay? I didn't leave the band to hurt anybody or run away from them. I left the band to go back to my life, I think, and reconnect with some foundational things that I felt, I think...
We're slipping away?
I think we're slipping away. Thank you. I think we're slipping away. I think that it was such an amazing ride that I was on. There was no room for anything else in my life. So I think I had to leave it all to open up and have some room for something else. And so that meant to go back and find out what that is.
Any regrets that you left or any regrets the way your life unfolded?
Mm-mm, I don't. It was like tempering steel, to be honest with you. Steel is kind of soft until you heat it up. I had to get heated up and then put in the cold water and heat it up and put in the cold water. And it kind of tempered me. At this point in my age right now, I don't have any regrets. I can tell you that though others may not agree with me, I think it was the best thing for everybody. I really do.
Before we go to break, at what moment did you think, wow, I have a good voice?
Probably singing into the well out at the ranch. It was so beautiful to hear that echo. I just loved the way it sounded. And then also, I used to sing, when I couldn't get to the ranch, I would unplug Mom's hose from the vacuum cleaner and put one in my left ear and sing in the other end. And I loved the way that sounded.
What would you sing?
I would just make things up. I don't know. I loved the way it sounded. I was really young. I do remember, though, the angels listening, when they heard me crying. You know, I remember those guys. I think it was the Crests. You know, I think it was the Crests.
And you must have been singing some Sam Cooke, too, back in the day.
Then
I
discovered
worshipped
him. Yeah, then I worshipped him because that was...
What was your favorite Sam Cooke song?
The first one would be Cupid came on the radio in my mom's 56 Thunderbird. And, oh, man, the whole world got so small. It got so tunnel vision. I'll never forget it. And I was just captivated by the emotion coming out of that speaker and how it was landing. And so I think that's what got me reaching for music from the very beginning was, why does this make me feel this way? What is happening here? You know, it connected with me, you know?
Can you sing Cupid? I know all the words.
Cupid, draw back your bow. And let your arrow flow straight to my lover's heart for me, nobody but me. Now, I can't sing. See, now I'm criticizing that. Just to show you, I just criticized four phrases that I just sang at the same time I was singing them, okay? And I really got to tell you, without echo, I'm singing dry in this room. I don't sing dry.
Well, thank you for singing dry for us.
Quick pro quo.
No. But my favorite Sam Cooke is, don't know much about history.
Don't know much biology. Don't know much about the French I took. Don't know much about the... But I do know that I love you, right? And I know that if you love me too, what a wonderful world this would be.
God, harmony,
see?
Sounded good.
I just
right?
sound harmony on
yeah.
you, see?
I'll never forget when that was in the movie Witness, and Harrison Ford and Kelly McGinnis were dancing. It was so sexy.
Of course.
Love that song.
And isn't that what it's about? It really is about the intimacy of music. It's so personal.
Well, I'm excited to talk to you more about this new album and the genesis of this album. We'll talk about that right after this. Hey everyone, it's Katie Couric, and I want to tell you about one of my new favorite podcasts. It's called A Really Good Cry with the amazing Roddy Devlukia, a plant-based chef, entrepreneur, and now a podcast host who will guide you through a journey of self-discovery, one tear at a time. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Roddy Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
We started talking about this incident. Drugs and officials cover up. You couldn't believe it.
From iHeart Podcasts.
It's like the police knew who he was before they got here.
A story about money, power, and corruption.
The medical school dean at USC was leading a secret double life.
He's breathing right now?
Yes, he's absolutely breathing. I'm a doctor, actually.
There's no way that that guy's a doctor.
I'm Paul Pringle, and I'm an investigative reporter for the LA Times. This is the story of an investigation that starts in a hotel room in Pasadena, California, and reaches all the way to the top of two of the most powerful institutions in the city of Los Angeles.
When people fall in line, they fall in line.
Looking back, I realized, oh, everyone knew.
This is Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption.
We're always going to have predators. It's the good people who stand by and do nothing that allow them to flourish.
Listen to Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, my name's Jay Shetty, and I'm the host of On Purpose. I just had a great conversation with Michael B. Jordan, and you can listen to it right now. Michael is known for his performances in both film and television. His breakout role was in Fruitvale Station, playing Oscar Grant, which earned him widespread praise and numerous award nominations. His portrayal of Killmonger in Marvel's Black Panther, one of my favorites, further solidified his status as one of Hollywood's leading actors, earning him widespread acclaim for his complex and compelling performance. In our conversation, Michael really opens up. You're going to love listening to it, and I can't wait for you to check it out.
The closest to getting what you want is always the hardest. It's always the feeling when you're getting ready to, you know, people give up right before they get what they've always wanted to get. People quit.
Listen to On Purpose with Jay Shetty on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Now back to my interview with Steve Perry. So Steve, you're back. Yeah. After all these years.
After all these years.
Still crazy after all
yeah,
these years.
Yeah, I know it's too. Been a long time coming yeah, since yeah. I saw your face. I know.
So let's talk about this new album, Traces. And it comes from a deeply, deeply personal place. You fell in love with someone who unfortunately was diagnosed with breast cancer, was in remission when you first learned about her. Mm-hmm. And then when you met her, it had
come back.
Spread and yeah. come back, and you decided to jump into the relationship anyway.
Yeah.
What was it about that relationship that just almost had the same attraction for you as music, it sounds like?
It was just almost terrifyingly wonderful, because I could not stay away from her, and I knew she was sick. It was like, what am I doing? There was times I would talk to a therapist and say, what am I doing?
I was going to say, you know? I wonder if there was something about the potentially ephemeral nature of that relationship that somehow attracted you, not to be your
what
therapist.
What is ephemeral? What's ephemeral
sort
mean?
Sort of fleeting, you know, not permanent.
Wow. I don't know. All I know is that the connection was so strong, and it was very, very difficult to not run. At the same time, there was this incredible connection that said, you have nowhere to run. There's nowhere else you want to be. Like, I talked to Nico Bolas, a friend of mine, an engineer, and one day I was watching him work, and I had just started seeing Kelly, and he said, what are you doing here? I said, well, I'm hanging out with you, watching you mix a little bit on this cool band. He said, man, you should be with your girl. I said, well, we went out a few times. He said, I'm not sure what to do about that. I'm just very confused about it because it's scary because she's not well. I don't want to fall in love and lose again. I don't know what to do, you know? He said, dude, I've never seen you like this before. He says, I have never seen you so happy with anyone. There's something else going on for you and her. He said, man, you should be with your girl, man. That's your girl. I could tell that. And so I left, called her, went and had lunch, and that continued.
How long were you together?
A year and a half.
How long was she sick, really sick, during that period of time?
Off and on the whole time, but not as bad as it got, of course. The last, I would say the last 6 months, especially the last 3 months, of course, were the worst. But there was a time here in New York where she was on this incredible clinical trial treatment that didn't make her sick. It was invented by this guy, and it was doing amazing things for her. And she had tumors in her lungs, and she had some in her bone marrow. And we would do the scans, and the tumors would have scar tissue where the MRI would show this. Well, there was scar tissue there, but I don't see the tumors anymore, they would say. And we'd look at each other and say, What did he say? You know? And we would go from not being able to ride bicycles in New York to riding bicycles in the park. And just thinking, oh, my God, this is insane. This is so great, you know? And then come around September of that year is when she said, you know, honey, something's not right. I don't know what it is. I know my body. Believe me, something's not right. Did a scan and it'd come back, you know, so.
Cancer is so cruel, you know?
Let's
talk about the promise you made to Kelly, Steve. You said that you would not go back into isolation, that you would put out some of the music that you were writing and thinking about. Tell me about the promise you made to her.
Well, my favorite time we would spend together was, you know, at the end of the day, we would turn the lights down, give each other a smooch, and I'd either talk her to sleep or she'd talk me to sleep. And one night she said, honey, I need to ask you to make me a promise. And I said, well, what's that? I want you to promise that if something ever happened to me, that you would not go back into isolation, for I think it would make this all for naught. So I was never given such an amazing long sentence with so encompassing value of my whole everything like that. But remember, she was a PhD psychologist, so she was very good assembling her words and very clear when she had something to say or feel. You're going to hear pretty much to the bone what it is. And this was one of those moments. So I said, of course I promise I won't go back into isolation. But look, it wasn't like we weren't hanging out or going on trips or having dinner with friends. We were living our lives. But she knew that I was isolating from music. She knew I was isolating from singing. I never really sang much. So that's what she was talking about.
Your new album, Traces, is full of ballads. Some are sad. Others are nostalgic. Mm-hmm, and I think people listening to this one song called No More Crying would assume it's about losing Kelly. Let's listen to a little bit, and you can tell us how that song came about. Let's talk about that song.
Well, actually, that song is more of a different sort of dyslexic version of what you're saying. Meaning, he's trying to convince himself the answer to not crying is to just not love again, and basically to shut down his heart. Now, there is that component in there. It is a relationship song. But if you listen to the second verse, I'm so free, I need nobody. No more lies, no surprises, no confrontations. It's a peaceful life behind closed doors. But in the dark of a night, I start to remember, okay? So that whole arc of all those lyrics right there is about isolation and how just pull away from it all and you won't have to deal with lies. And by the way, there's a bit of my past in there, okay? But lies and confrontations and, you know, surprises. I mean, there was a lot of surprises that when you're in a band, you're being told to do and go and perform or do places that you just don't want to do. But guess what? It's been booked and you're stuck. So there was always this stuff I didn't like too much either. So there's a bit of my past in all this. But let me tell you, the song I think you're really looking for is Most of All. Now, if they have Most of All here, if you were to hear the opening line of Most of All, he says, promises that won't fade away. It's about reflecting all those memories. It's about the whole thing to the ones who've lost their most of all. Many years won't heal when tears still call their most of all. You know, that song I wrote with Randy Goodrum before I met Kelly, and it turned out it ended up becoming a song about her.
Let's listen to it for a second.
Promises that won't fade away. Golden memories that will never erase all the plans and dreams so hard to replace from another place to another town. Still drifting to the ones who've lost their most of all. Many years won't heal when tears still call.
Were you surprised, Steve, that a song that you had already written before you met Kelly seemed to reflect?
Look, I have goosebumps on my arms.
Was so prescient.
I can't make that happen. It's something that happens to me. Where that comes from is life-sustaining and is the most important thing in my life right now, Katie. I mean, to connect with music like that, and even if it's my own music, it means so much to me at this time in my life. I'm not a spring chicken, honey, okay? You know, and I need this so more than I've ever needed it in my whole life.
This
connection with emotion and music and songwriting. Nothing means more to me than reconnecting like a song like that. The lyrics of that, I'm so proud of them because he's just being honest about the memories and everything that's going on. And then he says, from another place to another town, still drifting. That's what I did when I was home. He just shifts. He goes, he's being memorable. Then he shifts to like just drifting around again, lost. But to the ones who've lost their most of all, many years won't heal when tears still call their most of all. That means so much to me. I need that out there for me. I just hope it touches somebody. But for me, I mean, I need it.
I think that also there's some very up-tempo songs, kind of,
yeah, of course,
rocker, I mean, songs, like No Erasin', which is about a high school reunion.
Yeah.
Let's listen to that song for a second. What is it about high school that keeps drawing you back there, Steve?
I think we're all in high school still. I think emotionally, if we look honestly within ourselves, some of our teenage years, the foundation of our hearts and soul, were completely fed by all the fantasies, these teenage fantasies of our youth.
I read that you don't like to dissect songs because you say if you talk too much about what they mean, it takes away the ability for everyone to interpret it for themselves.
That's right.
And for have it to make it meaningful for them.
It makes
and their
it
own experience.
Their own experience.
Yeah.
That's right.
Having said that, I love the story behind Don't Stop Believin'. So you have to tell us a little bit about the circumstances. You're in a hotel.
Yeah.
No.
Okay, I'm in a hotel in Detroit, and we just finished a show at the Cobo Hall, and I think it was the Pontchartrain. Somebody brought it to my attention, hotel. And I'm at the top floor looking down, and I'm not sleepy. It's about 3 in the morning. I'm seeing the streetlights glowing the entire streets from the top down, and they're sort of a rust-colored amber color, and I just could not believe it. And everybody's still milling around, you know? And I thought, these are like streetlight people. They're like people living under these streetlights, and it's 3 in the morning. So I remember that, streetlight people, and then
up and down the boulevard.
Up and down the boulevard, that's right. And then I remembered there was this place in my hometown called the El Rancho Hotel that had a bar, a terrible bar and club with a little stage in the corner. That's where I used to play all my cover band music with the band I was in at the time. And you'd walk into this place and it had a red carpet that was just stained with all sorts of alcohol and wine spilling and everything. And they never washed it.
Was there the smell of wine and cheap perfume?
Women would wear the cheapest perfume, okay, to show up, you know, to try to have a smile and share the night, right? So that came from, it came from there, you know.
And so that was just sort of reflections of a bunch of different places in your life. Detroit,
that's right.
And
that's right.
This seedy motel or hotel.
That's right.
Yeah. And ultimately, though, it's a love story, isn't it?
Well, it's about not giving up. It's really about, you know, you got to keep believing. It's about a city boy and a city girl and just
living in a lonely world.
Well, yeah, taking the midnight train to anywhere. It's about throwing yourself to the wind. And just living your life, you know. I think that is what resonates with the youth of today, because the song really is about, it's okay where you're at right now. You're doing what you're supposed to be doing. You're throwing your life to the wind and just follow the wind, you know.
It must be fun for you to see a whole new generation fall in love with Journey.
Yeah.
Oh, the music
it's amazing.
You made.
It's amazing.
I think we can give a little credit, possibly, to the cast of Glee,
yeah,
which covered Don't Stop Believin'. So let's listen for a second. When you saw that on Glee, Steve, did you get such a kick out of it? Because I remember my daughter, we were super, you know, Glee freaks. I guess they called them Gleeks. We used to watch it. You know, it was our thing we did together. And Carrie used to record herself and put herself on YouTube. She's since taken it down. singing Don't Stop Believing. And I mean, it really, did you get a kick out of that?
I did. Because it was a whole new generation. And again, a high school generation, you see? It's that period that I'm talking about that is an important period in any evolution of a human being. It just is a magical time, our teen years. And to see that song become part of the joys of that generation really, really warmed my heart. And then it continued, by the way, you know. I mean, it continued all sorts of places, sporting events, and ended up with Sopranos, of course.
Well, you know, of course. And that was a thrill for you. Yeah. I know that they reached out, that you knew before the rest of the country.
I did know the
what
ending.
Was going to happen at the end of The Sopranos.
Because I held out. I was the only one who held out. You know, there's 3 writers, and everybody said yes but me. And the only reason I held out was because I wanted to make sure that David Chase wasn't going to whack the whole family with the song playing, you know, because Scorsese would do that.
You know, going to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, was it great seeing your bandmates, or were you conflicted?
I was conflicted, and I almost didn't go because I was so conflicted. But what happened was I started going online, and I remembered the times I had spent away in my hometown that we spoke of earlier. And all my heroes that I grew up with on those 45s were inducted. And I thought, oh, my God, this is where I'm going? I'm getting goosebumps again. See my arms?
Yeah.
Because I really felt like, oh, my God, this is real. I'm really going to be inducted with my heroes, the ones that I looked up to. So I felt a sense of purpose and insistence within myself that I must be there. Because at that point, no matter what we did or didn't do, or, you know, you can still love somebody and not hang out with them, by the way. You know, I really think that needs to be said, all right? And so the point is that I still have feelings for, because we were in the trenches together as a group trying to accomplish a mission that, you know, the concept of a band is when you band together to do collectively what you can't do by yourself.
It would have been so epic if you had just done one song, but you didn't want to.
I understand that.
But that would have been epic.
But instead, I wanted to pay tribute to everyone who had done so much for giving this kid, a San Joaquin Valley kid from the Hanford, California, a chance to live his dream and chase after it. That meant more to me. I thank Greg Rowley. I thank Neil Sean. I thank the manager for believing me. And then I had to thank Arnell for pouring his heart out every night for 10 years.
That's the guy who, I can't say your replacement, but the guy who became the lead singer.
But he's so good. He's a good kid. He really has been pouring his heart out in that band for 10 years.
And you've been so generous about it.
Look, why not? I mean, that's the way I see it.
If you had some good times with these band members. Obviously, you didn't see eye to eye. Obviously, you got on each other's nerves and you were happy to walk away. But, you know, a lot of this is about friendship. And I don't know. I have friends that I'm no longer friends with. And
why though? Tell me why.
Well, no. I mean, it's too complicated. But it always
That's not fair.
It leaves a bit of a hole in my heart.
Well, it leaves a hole in your heart. But it is too complicated. Why? Why can't you go back to your friends? Because it's complicated.
I should. I want to, and I hope I will.
But it's
back to you.
But it's very complicated and very difficult.
I should. I hope to, and one day I will. And you?
I don't know if I can.
Why not?
It's too complicated.
Just can't go back?
No, I don't think people can go back. I think that's one of the things I learned when I was away, that if I'm going to push through life, I like the adventure of always going somewhere I've never been and growing with that. And the biggest thing, Katie, the biggest thing is a second ago I just played Most of All for you. And I got goosebumps on my arm. I have not had that connection with something I lost when I left the group in years. Remember, 31 years I left. Then somewhere in the middle, I came back to them again, tried. I tried to go back. It didn't work a second time. Why should I try a third time if it didn't work the second time?
And I'm not even talking about music. I'm talking about a relationship, I guess, Steve.
Look, if relationships were possible like that, I just don't know if people can separate their motives from their relationships, if you know what I mean.
I think I know what you mean.
Yeah. Really. I mean, it's friendships are private and intimate and protective to themselves. When they get spilled into motives, it doesn't feel like a friendship.
It seems like you're afraid to rekindle a relationship for fear it will be exploited for something else.
Pretty much. If it's going to be a friendship, exploitation of a friendship is just not a friendship. I don't know. Time tells everything. You know, life is a very strange place.
And I think that the Eels, the lead singer of the Eels, he said, Steve Perry moves in mysterious ways. Do you think you're going to do another album? I mean, is this reconnection with music going to last? Or do you think that this is a new chapter and we'll be hearing a lot more from you?
I have so much stuff I want to do. I've got songs started. I've got songs already recorded that are sketched. I've got more material. I have more material than I need and maybe than I have time left in my life to finish, to be honest. It's a commitment to continue to make music for the time I have left. I tell you from the bottom of my heart, this is life-sustaining to me. And I need that right now because, Katie, I've lost my mother, my dad, my grandparents who raised me. I'm an only child. I need this.
Why didn't you ever get married, Steve?
Scared. And I'll tell you, with Kelly, I was really close, so close. Just didn't like what happened and what I saw growing up and just don't think it was for me. And then I was deposed in so many divorces with the band members, one after another. And the next time I turn around, this guy's marrying a new one. And now I've been across at least three wives with one guy. while I was in the band, and a couple with others, and deposed because you're in a partnership together. So I watch them lose half of everything every time, and I'm thinking, it's not how much you make, it's how much you save. So maybe I should stay single.
Or have a good prenup, Steve.
Well, I hear they're not so great.
And I know the album is doing great.
It is doing great. I'm so happy.
Which must make you so happy.
I'm so happy. Nothing makes me happier right now than the people hear this music and hopefully love it and feel it. That's all I want. That's all. I don't care if they stream it. I don't even care.
I'm so happy for this new chapter in your life, and I wish you a lot of happiness, but I also wish you a lot of peace, Steve Perry. On that note, that wraps up my interview with Steve Perry. Such a treat to talk with him and to sing with him, too.
Well, Katie, we've gotten a lot of listener emails asking for more singing from you, not from me.
Well, I have to give the people what they want then, Brian.
You do. You do.
Before we go, I want to thank the team that produces this podcast, producer Emma Morgenstern, associate producer Nora Ritchie, Jared O'Connell, our engineer, and special thanks to my good friend Matt Lombardi, who really helped me so much with this episode. Matt, reunited, and it feels so good. Also, thank you, Gianna Palmer, for your help, and Casey Holford for putting up with Steve and me on a Saturday morning in the studio.
Thanks to everyone at Katie Couric Media. Beth DeMaz is Katie's assistant and a fabulous one at that. And Julia Lewis is the social media whiz.
Jared Arnold composed our theme music. You can find Brian on Twitter under GoldsmithB, and I am everywhere, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, all as Katie Couric.
If you have thoughts about the show or questions for Katie or me or guest suggestions or really anything, please reach out. Our email address is comments@couricpodcast.com, or you can leave us a voicemail by calling 929-224-4637. We'll talk to you next week.
Coming back to Atlanta. Right now. Whoa. Mark your calendars, because the second annual Black Effect Podcast Festival is happening on Saturday, April 27th. Hosted by B-Dot and Pretty V. Last year was nuts, but we about to do it bigger and better. We've got some of your favorite podcasts like Carefully Reckless, Horrible Decision, $1 million Worth of Game, just to name a few. Tickets go on sale today, right now. Go to blackeffect.com/podcastfestival. Get them. We'll see you there.
Hey everyone, it's Katie Couric, and I want to tell you about one of my new favorite podcasts. It's called A Really Good Cry with the amazing Roddy Devlukia, a plant-based chef, entrepreneur, and now a podcast host who will guide you through a journey of self-discovery, one tear at a time. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Roddy Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where my new podcast begins. This is Neil Strauss, host of To Live and Die in LA, and I wanted to quickly tell you about an intense new series about a dangerous spy taught to seduce men for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, this is To Die For. To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.